Do you want to start with a few words or just go straight into questions? Or?
Well, I think maybe go straight into questions.
Straight into questions.
If you would like.
We're expecting one more camera crew, but they're a bit lost. So we can go ahead and start. The ones who interviewed you yesterday.
Ah, right.
Yeah, I mean, probably what's particularly pertinent is that Sylvia Cartwright was a judge on a tribunal that was a mixture of international and national judges. So that's obviously mm-hmm. particularly relevant in the case of Sri Lanka.
Perhaps just to also explain this model used for the Sri Lanka report was a bit different to the commissions of inquiry that you might have been familiar with. In the past, in that the distinguished experts played a sort of advisory, supportive role behind the scenes, rather than conducting the inquiry themselves. So occasionally I've seen it referred to as as if the this is the report of the three experts and so forth. Very much the report of the High Commissioner and the experts have helped in the process. Mm.
Can I ask a question? With respect to the draft resolution that we see online and operative item number 6, the notion coming out of Colombo is that the participation of foreign judges and defense lawyers will be at their discretion. That they note that some people may feel it's a good idea, but that's certainly not binding, and they'll basically can make ad hoc decisions if they choose. Is that not dangerous? If the goal is to avoid any impartiality in the court?
Well, a better model would be to have much more discussion with international advisors and to have a selection process that that incorporates both Sri Lankan and international experts for all parts of the court, not just the judges, all the other important players as well. That would give much more comfort to those who feel that the Sri Lankan system of justice has been compromised, whether that's correct or not. But certainly to have a process that looks independent, that is in fact independent, would be a much better way to go.
Okay. Can I follow up? I mean, Human Rights Watch went, I think, further than the High Commissioner in saying this needs to be led by foreign judges and led by foreign prosecutors. Mm-hmm. Are you guys going that far in saying that's the best model, that the actual leadership structure is non-Sri Lankan, or is that sort of unrealistic, never mm-hmm. going to happen, no mm-hmm. point in talking about it?
Well, perhaps it's best if I describe what the model might look like. What I anticipate is that there will be a court which is based in the Sri Lankan legal system, which follows Sri Lankan law and procedures, provided that they can cope with international criminal law. So there will be a lot of amendments both to law and procedures before a court can conduct trials related to international criminal law. That means that you have to have people with experience in international criminal law. And what I would anticipate is a court that sits in Sri Lanka, that has both Sri Lankan and international defence lawyers, prosecutors, those protecting witnesses and victims, as well as judges. Now, the exact model has not been established, and that's where the discussion has to start. I don't think the focus always on the judges is particularly useful, because judges are only one part in this very broad exercise of establishing a court. And, of course, you will need to have investigators who have experience in international crimes, because they're very different from domestic crimes. The worst sort of crime that you can try in a domestic court would normally be something like a murder, something of that nature. Well, international criminal trials covering a murder, you might have 5,000 murders to deal with. You might need forensic assistance. Most domestic jurisdictions don't have experience in that, and Sri Lanka is no different in that regard. It's not a criticism of the Sri Lankan legal system. It's an acknowledgement that they need more experience from the international field.
Can I just follow up on that and ask, do you then feel that the resolution provides a sufficient basis, leaves sufficient room for what you would think would be a credible process?
The resolution to me is a starting point, and it does not exclude any model that would work in Sri Lanka. And all is going to depend on the negotiations and the discussions and the decisions that are made from this point on. But I think it needs emphasising that integration of international actors is vital if the process is to be credible in Sri Lanka and for the rest of the world.
Was there any discussion at all of an Arusha-type model or a Yugoslavia-type model of locating it elsewhere and really taking the process?
I'm not aware of that. My understanding is that it's always been intended that it be an international integrated court within Sri Lanka, and I personally, for what it's worth, would certainly advocate that. It has huge advantages for the people of Sri Lanka. And perhaps it's worth talking about my experience in Cambodia, where the court was based in Phnom Penh, and where something like 100,000 people, locals, have actually visited the court over the period that it's been sitting there. And as well as that, the outreach program has meant that hundreds of thousands more have been made familiar with the work of the court. And the trust in the institution of the courts in Cambodia has risen significantly over the period that those trials have been running in Cambodia. So it has huge advantages for the local people to be able to see and access justice in their own country.
And following your experience in Cambodia, do you have any guidance that you believe works with respect to keeping the politics out of the court construction? I know impartiality is key, but any specific lessons that can be applied to Sri Lanka, we know this is a good way to keep political interests out of this process.
Well, the most important thing is to establish an institution, a court, that is independent, that is guaranteed independence, and let the lawyers and judges get on with it. That requires trusting the institution that you've established, and I'm sure that will occur if there is integrated international lawyers, judges, investigators, and so on. Because once you start working, you know, as a professional, you kind of forget that there's swirling politics out there. You just get on with the job. And my experience in Cambodia was certainly that although at first there might have been uncertainty in putting together Cambodian and international judges, as we started to work together, it just became an ordinary court. Well, an extraordinary ordinary court. I can't call it an everyday court, but none of these courts are these international courts. So I think it's really important to have good, solid selection of both domestic lawyers, judges, investigators, and international ones.
Now, the High Commissioner's report makes explicit reference to the weakness of Sri Lankan law in terms of dealing with these kinds of crimes. It sounds like an incredibly long process to get kind of legal reforms you need to provide a context, a legal framework in which trials can go forward, and then to actually set up these structures. What do you think would be realistic?
I cannot predict that, but you are right, it takes time. There will need to be legislation to make sure that the court can operate within the Sri Lankan court system. But once that's done, then the rules of procedure could take a few months to prepare, because you cannot say that there's any actual precedent for any court that operates. You have to pretty much start with a draft and work out how it's going to work in the system that you've developed. So that will take a little bit of time. And there's always huge pressure on these courts to get started. But unless you have this preliminary work done well and solidly, then they're not going to be successful. So you have to allow time for, not so much for the legislation, because that should be a relatively straightforward process, provided that the domestic politics don't interfere too much. But certainly making sure that the rules of procedure provide for a robust and independent court will take a little bit of time.
In Cambodia, is it fair to say that you were helped by the fact that a lot of the perpetrators had long since lost political power by the time you got started? Whereas a complicating factor in Sri Lanka is that some of those who may possibly be implicated are still very significant players on the political landscape. How much more difficult might that make things?
Cambodia was a bit unusual because the events had occurred, 30-odd years earlier. And so witness protection was not so critical as it was in, for example, the Yugoslavia tribunal, where the events were much fresher, as is the case in Sri Lanka. So, yes, it does take a lot more care when the events are fresh. Witness protection is absolutely vital, but you also haven't allowed for the fact that there are difficulties in running a trial many years after the events, which created its own problems. Witness memories, the health of the accused. We had lengthy, lengthy hearings relating to dementia with one of the accused. That is unlikely to happen where the events are much closer. So you have a sort of swings and roundabouts principle at play here.
Your report talks about sexual crimes committed that you with a baton. There are huge concerns regarding the witness protection mechanisms in Sri Lanka. What do you think must be done to bring the element of gender sensitivity into the legal mechanism to ensure such witnesses are protected and there is an element of gender sensitivity in it?
Well, again, I emphasise the importance, the absolute vital importance of a good witness protection and victim protection programme, which not only protects from people from fears for life and limb, but also the sensitivity of dealing with sexual crimes. Most professional lawyers and judges these days are trained or have lots of experience in dealing with sensitive crimes like this, and that will certainly be a focus of attention in Sri Lanka, I'm quite sure. There are many, many experts who can offer assistance to the lawyers and judges, but I can assure you that professionally, certainly at the international level, I can't speak for Sri Lanka, but certainly at the international level, it is a very important part of the experience of lawyers and judges, investigators and so on.
Any more? Stephanie?
Well, I'm not quite sure of what is intended by that term, special counsel. I'm not familiar with the Sri Lankan procedural models, and so it may have its own particular definition within their procedures. I would have thought it probably refers to overall control of the prosecutions or something of that nature. I don't mean saying who should be prosecuted and who shouldn't be. Politically, I mean, as a professional job, do we have enough evidence to prosecute this person, etc.? So I can't help you any more than that, I'm afraid.
But it would be a key role.
I don't know. I don't know.
I could maybe add here, I mean, although, you know, don't quote me personally, but I think this relates to the long-standing concerns with the Attorney General's office in Sri Lanka. And when the government evolved its thinking on these mechanisms, I think they recognised that, to have a credible process and to address the issues of confidence, something would need to be created separate to the regular Attorney General's structure. The problem with the Attorney General in Sri Lanka is that, you know, they have multiple roles that, you know, overlap and conflict. They lead evidence in commissions of inquiry and criminal proceedings. At the same time, they act as, well, firstly, they take a decision on what cases to bring to trial. They lead evidence in cases, and they also defend state agents in cases. And so, you know, the combination of these elements, together with the sort of the loss of independence of that institution over the years, has sort of been a big problem with past commissions of inquiry. So I think the government's intention was to create a special prosecutor's office, essentially, to serve this process, and I think that's where the
would be integrated into. Yes, it would be integrated into this court.
That's
it, can't be external to it.
We don't know. I mean, we don't. A lot of these issues of design are still to be spelled out. But I think this was the thinking on their side in calling it a special counsel.
In many hybrid mechanisms, there have been precedents of setting up these courts and these mechanisms outside the country as well. Considering, as far as this report is concerned, major inputs have come out from people outside Sri Lanka, victims and witnesses living outside Sri Lanka. Don't you think it's better to have a mechanism outside the country as well, so a lot of them fear persecution?
Well, there are advantages and disadvantages in either model. If you have the court outside the country, certainly you are serving the diaspora much better, but you're not serving the people in the country. And so that's a decision that will have to be made, and I'm not sure whether it's been finally made or not, but I've always assumed it would be in country, but I'm not the decision maker here.
Yeah. And I just add a point on that. I think one of the aspects of the new victim and witness protection law in Sri Lanka is a provision for witnesses to give testimony from remote locations outside of the court, which is a good thing. The problem is, as it's currently framed, that remote location has to be inside Sri Lanka, which would involve, therefore, you know, a victim or a witness returning, you know, from abroad to some special arrangement in Sri Lanka. One of our recommendations and observations on that law has always been that that provision should be broadened, in fact, to allow witnesses to give evidence from remote locations outside the country, obviously set up under certain conditions with certain safeguards and links to the formal process. But that would provide a much better facility for taking evidence in these cases where witnesses are still under significant threat. And there were some precedents for this in some of the previous commissions of inquiry actually went this step of taking video testimony from abroad.
It was used extensively in Cambodia, because of the particular circumstances of that court, more for elderly people who didn't want to have to travel, etc. But building on the witness protection law in Sri Lanka, the court will develop its own rules around this sort of process, and will decide whether and under what circumstances remote testimony can be taken. So you start with Sri Lankan law, but you have to develop your own processes for the particular needs of this court.
You and your colleagues as the special advisors to the report, did your role stop with that, or do you have a continuing function in return in relation to advising the process for establishing this mechanism?
Well, our role officially stopped with the delivery of the report, but the High Commissioner has asked us informally to remain available, but there's nothing formal in place, and I don't think any of us anticipate being an ongoing part of the process because our job was in relation to the report.
AP's just arrived, so I don't know if you have a... Do you have a question? Otherwise we may end.
So is your conception then of this court, it would be just to the end of hostilities in May 2009, or would it extend beyond during that period when people were missing, and how do you see them defining that?
Well, that will depend on discussions between Sri Lanka and any international bodies involved in the discussions. But at the moment, it is at least 2002 to 2011, which was the period of that the report covered. But temporal jurisdiction is always problematic, and it needs to be discussed very carefully when the law relating to the court is established.
On the report, there's another accusation that comes from Sri Lanka, that the report soft pedals the crimes committed by the LTT. This is the accusation that many sections of Sri Lanka are raising. And you've also pointed out in the report that the challenges that you face with respect to the witnesses and victims, being reluctant, talking about the crimes committed by the LTT. What do you have to say on the allegation that your report is soft-pedaling on the accusation on the crimes committed by the LTT?
Well, we just don't know yet, do we? Because we haven't had a criminal investigation. This is an investigation of violations of human rights and humanitarian law, not of crimes. And it was done under some difficulty insofar as the investigators for this report could not go to the country. So it's very hard to say what else may be uncovered in the event of a criminal investigation. And indeed, it will be of a different shape to the report. I'm quite certain of that. It will have many of the same elements, but there will be other factors that are as yet unknown.
Any more questions? Daisy lot.
Are you aware of, has there been any significant accumulation prosecutorial material, stuff that would provide the basis for individual cases to be taken up as part of criminal process?
Well, I think that there's been an accumulation of a vast amount of material by the investigation team, which remains confidential for obvious reasons, and there will have to be discussions and negotiations about how that material is dealt with once there are safeguards to protect it. It would, if to be handed over at all, it would have to be handed over under very strict legal provisions.
I think one of the recommendations that's maybe not received much attention, but one of the recommendations in the report is very much concerned with the preservation of archives and documentation. Certainly that held by public institutions in Sri Lanka, including the military, of course, a very important to put a ring fence around that. But also by many private actors, non-governmental organisations and others who've accumulated a huge amount of documentation over the years of how to, preserve, bring together, analyse, and map all of that material, which will be a hugely important basis for what happens next.
Mm.
Do you have any indications that some of that may have been destroyed or is being destroyed?
There are never complete archives during and after a conflict, but it's very important that, so far as is possible, what is there still is preserved, so that not only for court purposes but for historical purposes.
I think one of the illustrations of the challenge, for instance, has been the apparent difficulty, or the time at least, that the government has taken to produce a codified list of detainees.
Mm.
And an accounting for who is still in detention, who has passed through detention, who has passed through rehabilitation, where people are now. And this bureaucratic side of things, this documentation of the handling of people, should exist in some form. So this is where I think the information issue is so important.
Okay, any last questions?
Given the potentially enormous number of people who could be the subject of investigation, potentially prosecution, would like some kind of guidance on how you set about prioritising who is put on trial, what cases you select. In the case of Cambodia, it seems to be a very small number of people who have been brought to trial. In this situation where you've got many more people still active, what is the process by which you kind of select cases for prosecution and the priorities that you give to that, and kind of the timeline for developing?
Mm. That's a decision to be made by prosecutors, but they have to start with the personal jurisdiction, which will be established by agreement. In Cambodia, it was those most senior and or most responsible for the Pol Pot period. And that meant that you could just look at the most senior people, the real leaders, because you can't possibly run enough trials to deal with the middle management level, if you like. And I would think some articulation. So far, it's those most responsible. So far, it's those most responsible. But that will require some very careful discussion. And then, starting from that principle, the prosecutors will make decisions. And a lot of it depends on, in practical terms, what material they have available as to which one comes to trial first. Just the usual practical issues.
I think you also said the other day that some other cases, maybe at lower levels, could be dealt with in the national courts.
Yes.
as a straightforward murder cases, in a sense.
We can't rely on a court of the nature that's being discussed here today, which is based in Sri Lankan law with Sri Lankan and international involvement, or integrated court. You have to have other facilities as well, and of course the Truth and Reconciliation model has been proposed. That is something that will deal with people at the much lower level, the victim who wants to know what happened to their father or brother or sister or whatever, which the leaders never know. So this will give help to the victims if it's established properly. As well as that, there is absolutely no reason why ordinary, everyday, single murders, rapes and so on shouldn't be tried in the domestic courts. That would be perfectly normal. So that if there is evidence of one person killing another or raping another person, then you take that to the domestic court, unless that person is at a most senior level where there's command and superior responsibility elements involved, and although they might not have perpetrated the particular acts themselves, they are the ones who either directed or allowed this to happen. So there are several layers to achieve justice in a situation like this.
So in a report like the OISL, when a vast majority of the victims were actually sourced from overseas, how would that process work? Are they expected to go back to sit in domestic court to contribute, or will there be like a kind of roaming court system that deals with witnesses from outside the country? Mm.
Well, this is where taking testimony by remote means would be very useful. I can't answer for what might happen in the domestic courts, but certainly in a court that has integrated Sri Lankan and internationals, the remote testimony would be a very practical way to proceed.
Okay, one last question? The last question?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.